Welcome to Uncharted, an Arctic 360 podcast about the impact of COVID-19 on the North American Arctic. All summer long, we're talking to the people who live, work, and govern the Arctic to understand how we move forward from this moment in history. Today's theme is the Grays Bay Portin Road. It's a pretty important construction project that will connect a deep-sea port at the border of Nunavut and Yellowknife with the rest of the country. This is a region with a lot of minerals, a lot of resources, but not a lot of infrastructure to get to it. So this week I sit down with Scott Northey, the Chief Operating Officer of Nunavut Resources Company. Once part of the Toronto financial sector, he now plays a key role in getting the Grays Bay Portin Road project to be shovel-ready. We talk about the implications for the region, how to protect caribou migratory paths, and how the pandemic has made everything just a little bit more complicated. I'm Erica Wallace, and when it comes to COVID-19, this is Uncharted.
All right, well, let's get into it. I mean, first question I wanted to ask you is an easy one. It's just what inspired you to start working up in the Arctic? How did you come to work in this region when you're from Toronto?
Well, it's a relatively long story. It began with my previous career. I ran the infrastructure and project finance group at TD Securities here in Toronto. And the very last transaction I worked on was the financing of the Daycho Bridge, which is the very first man-made structure to go into the Mackenzie River and is a crucial link between Yellowknife and the rest of the world. Prior to the bridge going in, it was ferry service only. The original business model for that was for the community to actually own the bridge and collect an equity stipend from the toll revenue that was going to be charged on it. So we did the financing for that. I think it was $165 million in the end. We drove on. As a result of that, at 2008, when the credit crunch hit, I knew that my sector of the financial markets was going to be one of the slowest to recover. And I felt I was facing the prospect of as much as a year and a half of doing nothing. And the prospect of coming into work to do nothing wasn't very enticing. So I thought it was a good time for me to move on and try different things. And I started working with the other First Nations and some of their infrastructure plans, whether it was power-related projects or transportation-related projects. And around the same time, the Kitikmeot Inuit Association was setting up this entity called Nunavut Resources Corporation to try to get involved in infrastructure development in their own region. So they were tooling around Bay Street, connecting with all kinds of banks, and they asked my former employees, they met with them, and asked one of my former colleagues to join the board, and he was not allowed to, so he put my name forward, and then I was asked to join the board and help to develop the business model for how to do the infrastructure, get involved in infrastructure development, and our timing was good because the federal government had just launched the PPP, or Public-Private Partnerships Fund, which allowed people to apply for monies, and I view that as being a good source of Indigenous equity to try to find ways to finance infrastructure with third-party debt. So they liked what I had to say, and so they asked me to be an advisor, and then ultimately I took over the Chief Operating Officer role, and I've been at it since 2010.
Wow. So you're working now on the Grays Bay Portin Road project, right?
That's right, yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about that and kind of what your role is within it?
Sure. So as a result of the business model we developed, we looked at all kinds of different opportunities. One of them was a project that the KIA, the Kitikmeot Inuit Association, had tried to put forward in 2008, I believe, before I was involved. And it was called the Bathurst Inlet Port and Road, or BIPAR. And we made a couple of submissions to the PPP Canada Fund. Weren't successful, but certainly learned a lot and worked very hard to try to, get the message out that the Kitikmeot Inuit are very keen to be involved in infrastructure development in their region. We also looked at broadband. But at the end of the day, we had talked as part of our business model discussions. We talked to a mining company, MMG, who were in the midst of trying to develop a bunch of deposits that they had purchased recently. And they were very strongly of the view that they had their project was ridiculously feasible. And when we offered that we would build their road for them and they would lease it back from us for in terms of use, they kind of poo-pooed the idea and said, we'll be back to you once we get our feasibility study done. Well, it turned out their feasibility study showed that the project was actually infeasible because of the huge cost of assumed for building the road and port up front. Because you think about it, they have to put out the $550 million to build that. They then construct it, and then they build their mine and develop the mine. And so 7 years after they put the original $550 million in, they then start to generate revenue in support of that. And so that cost was just too high for the project to absorb. So they came back to us and said, is there a way that you guys can work with us to try to, implement your business model? And concurrently, they were talking with the government of Nunavut. And the government of Nunavut agreed. And so we started to working as co-project proponents to move this process forward and try to get it shovel ready as quickly as we possibly could. And so that's really what, my role specifically was to develop the business model to make it work and to work with the government of Nunavut as co-project proponent to try to move it forward. I will also say that 3 years ago, the government of Nunavut backed out of this project. I think I would argue it's political expediency. The Kitikmeot is the westernmost region in Nunavut. It's two time zones away from Iqaluit, which is where the capital is, and it's the smallest and most impoverished region, so they don't get a lot of attention out of Iqaluit. And as a result, this project looked like it was going to be going forward, but the government of Nunavut did not want to be a part of it. So since 2018, I think we've been working on our own, trying to move it forward, and we've had some success on that front.
Is it shovel ready yet, but hasn't started? Do I have that right?
No, it's not even close to where we got money out of the federal government last summer, end of summer, $22 million or just under $22 million to get the project shovel ready. And a bunch of things kicked in that have delayed or stalled that effort, notwithstanding, COVID has been a major reason. Mm-hmm. As a result of COVID, all field work was canceled, and so nobody could get out and do some more environmental EA-related research and do some more surveying and work on the engineering side as well. So the whole shovel-ready process is stalled, and we're kind of waiting for a reboot to figure out what's going to be happening going forward.
I guess, on the logistics side, how long would a project like this take to create? You kind of mentioned the environmental assessment. What kind of impact on the environment does it have?
So the first question is, our view is, MMG went pretty far down the road in terms of executing their own environmental assessment on the corridor as well as the port site. Mm-hmm. And so we have the benefit of more than $35 million worth of work that they did. So we have a huge head start on the environmental assessment part of the process. The EA process, we think, our shovel-ready process, we think could have been done in 3 years, but it looked like that's going to be totally off the table, and so we'll have to reboot our schedule and figure out what's next. The primary issues for environmentally are really caribou. Caribou are a migratory species, and they cross our corridor twice a year. Mm-hmm. In most years, and so as a consequence, obviously it's absolutely ingrained in Inuit culture, caribou, and so any threat to the caribou is might as well say, we might harm your mother, but it'll be okay. And so that's part of the challenge. But with at the heart of it, we're not driving this process. This is an Inuit-led project. Mm-hmm. And the leadership of the KIA are very strongly of the view that the caribou issues can be managed. And one of the things we've talked about is, from the port site, there will be no ice breaking, only ice moving. So at the point where the ice is firm enough for caribou to cross, there will be no shipping into the port. And then the second thing we talked about was, when the caribou within 30 kilometers of any part of the corridor will just shut traffic down entirely. And MMG had proposed this as a measure. And so they're clearly obviously on side with doing that. And there'll be the primary anchor tenant in our project when it moves forward. They'll be running about 6 or 7 trucks an hour down the road, and they're ready to be able to shut down for as much as 5 weeks.
Wow. So kind of working around the caribou season.
Yeah. And the periods when they may or may not be migrating. And that's part of the challenge. Their habits move, and no one understands why the habits move. It's like people talk about caribou calving grounds. It's not like salmon that return this exactly the same stream every spring. It's their calving grounds migrate in the way that they do. And my understanding is 25 years ago, the calving grounds for caribou were on the eastern side of Bathurst Inlet, which is about 350 kilometers away from our corridor. So there's no set rules, and that's I think one of the main arguments we've been trying to push forward, just to make sure that we're in a position to deal with the uncertainty associated with caribou migration.
Right. Huh. You mentioned as well that the Kitimat region is one of the most impoverished parts of Nunavut. What is the significance of this project to that community and to sort of the broader north?
So the Kitikmeot is a region. Nunavut is divided into 3 regions, and the Kitikmeot is the smallest, with about 7,000 people. 5,600 of them are Inuit beneficiaries. They're located in 5 communities, going from east to west, or west to east, I should say, is Kururoktuk, which is at the mouth of the Coppermine River. It used to be called Coppermine. Cambridge Bay, which is the regional hub of the Kitikmeot and largest population. Then on to Joe Haven on King William Island. And then Toyoak, which is on the Boothia Peninsula. And last but not least is Kugaruk, which is a really interesting community. It's the most isolated Inuit community in Nunavut, because notwithstanding it's easy to fly to, getting to it by water is a long, arduous process from anywhere in the rest of Nunavut. So they tend to be the most conservative in terms of their culture, and the fewest number of English speaking folks in that community, just because of their isolation and their adherence to traditional values. Sorry, what's the rest of the question on the KIA? Oh, and
the significance of the project. What does it mean?
It's massive. So the median income in the region, the last time I looked, it may have changed, and I may have some of the numbers not quite right. It may have been a community base, but median income in the region is $12,000. That means half are richer and half are poorer. The job opportunities are minuscule. And people are loath to leave their community, so the unemployment rate is exceptionally high. And so what this offers is not long term permanent jobs, not seasonal jobs. Directly at mines, in support of mine related activities, in support of mineral exploration activities, and in support of other logistical activities required to support both the mining industry, and as we hope, search and rescue and national defense, which we hope to be based out of the port. So it's really about job and employment, the job employment and business opportunities for Inuit and other Nunavummiut.
Can you walk me through some of the origins of this project? You mentioned when I spoke to you earlier about some of these failed efforts to access an Izok Lake deposit. What's the significance of that?
The Izok Lake deposit is right on the Nunavut Northwest Territories border. It is unbelievably isolated. The deposit was discovered in the early 70s by a Canadian mining company. Mm-hmm. And right now it is the highest quality zinc deposit in the entire world that remains undeveloped. And it's undeveloped because it's a relatively small deposit and it's inaccessible. A base metals deposit requires access to tidewater to be able to ship the ore to a smelter to be able to then process into the final metal. And the Izok deposit is about a 7 or 8 year old long deposit based on current production techniques. And it's just not big enough to be able to support the cost of a road and a port required to be able to get the ore out to tidewater. So MMG bought Izok Lake, and they bought High Lake, which is another high-quality zinc deposit, a little bit closer to tidewater, but there's a way to create a configuration that allows you to develop both deposits. and they've continued to search for other deposits that are in the neighborhood. But all that they found in terms of the zinc supports a total economic life of these deposits of around 13 to 15 years, and that's not long enough to make it work. So MMG is the most recent. They're funded by the Chinese government, so they're the required returns on investment the Chinese government are way lower than any other mining company. And I'll use the term internal rate of return, or IRR.
Okay.
For most mining companies, they're looking for a 15% IRR, and China would look for something closer to 9 or 10%, just to give you a sense of the discount. And even then, they couldn't make it work. So there have been, since the deposit was discovered in the early 70s, there have been, my understanding is, 10 different owners,
wow.
three of which went at it really aggressively, trying to find a way to make it work, and all three of them couldn't make it work. And the most recent serious effort was done by a former Canadian mining company that was eaten by another one, Inmet Mining. And, I met the CEO, the guy who was the CEO of Inmet at the time. He said if we'd come to him with his business model, he would have absolutely been all over that in the early 2000s, but it was long before we were around. So it's been a tale of woe. It's sitting there with all its value, stranded, doing nothing for anybody. And then that's one of the reasons, a key catalyst for this road, at least initially.
So this will be accessed through the Grays Road.
Yeah. So our road is intended to be a trunk road that runs from the port site south to an existing former mine site, the Jericho mine, which is a diamond mine. But the reason we're going there is because that's the top of the existing ice road from Yellowknife. So at least during the winter time, you'll have seasonal access all the way to the Canadian highway system. And the NWT is in the midst of trying to convert their winter road to an all-season road as well. So when that's successfully done, we'll have an all-season corridor going from anywhere in Canada to our port site.
Wow.
MMG, everyone is always saying, well, you're building this road for a Chinese mining company. Well, we're not, because they still have to build a 134-kilometer-long spur to our trunk road, but we're really helping their effort by building the port, building the road, and we think we can make, take advantage of them as an initial anchor tenant, for lack of a better term, to then attract other people who want to, it's an extremely mineral-rich region with gold, diamonds, base metals, and other precious metals, but it's underexplored massively because it's too expensive to get there. The only way to get there is by helicopter, and its helicopter time is just outrageously expensive.
Wow. Are there other similar projects to this one, or is Grays Bay kind of unique? Are there other ones that are, I don't know, in the works? It seems crazy to not have roads in the Arctic.
Yeah, no, there are no roads. This would be the first connection between Nunavut and the rest of Canada, and that's all of Nunavut, three time zones wide, and there's no terrestrial connection right now. There's another proposal in the central region called the Kivalliq, and the epicenter of the regional hub for Kivalliq is Rankin Inlet. There's a proposal in moving forward to try to extract low-cost hydro from Manitoba Hydro and running a transmission line north to power the existing gold mines that are in production in the Kivalliq region. Obviously that'd be a tremendous opportunity to do a bunch of stuff. But when you have a corridor, a transmission corridor, you've got to find ways to service it cheap, and usually that kind of a corridor is accompanied by road access.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing it's talking about is adding broadband to its capability. So that's the other one. I'd say they're about 10 years behind us in terms of state of development, because they're still trying to establish lines on a map where we have our configuration pretty much nailed down. But those are really the only two in Nunavut, and there are no real other in the western part of, or eastern part of Nunavut, which is Baffin region. It's all island and archipelagos. So there's nothing else you can really do in terms of terrestrial connections. I will say Quebec has put together something called Plan Nor, Plan of the North.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the status of that is, because there's a new government, but that certainly was a pretty aggressive and visionary approach to trying to get their Inuit part of the province connected to the rest of the province. So other than that, I'm not aware of any others.
Wow. I'm just wondering, compared to like Alaska, are there roads all throughout that region as well? Is this like a kind of Canadian problem to not have a developed Arctic?
Yes. Well, the short answer is yes. You know, the Yukon is exceptionally accessible. They've got a pretty extensive road network. NWT has not as big as Yukon's, but it's got but larger distances to span. But it's got a pretty good road network too. And they're looking to try to find ways to convert some of their existing winter roads, the Mackenzie Valley winter road into the Mackenzie Valley Highway, those kinds of things. Plus their portion of our corridor, which is called the Slave Geological Province Road. Alaska's much more accessible because they've got roads going to all coasts, north and west, and they seem to have been much more aggressive in terms of supporting Indigenous ownership of some of the infrastructure, which has led to some pretty significant development to help their mining and oil and gas industries move forward.
Is that from because of government help, or do you think that does come from, I don't know, just a stronger system sort of at the grassroots, like business level?
I believe government did have a pretty big role to play, but I think what their real role was to try to mobilize the Indians, they call them in Alaska, not First Nations, to mobilize the Indian groups together to get involved and try to take ownership. They also have the advantage at the heart of it. The model that everyone looks at is the Red Dog Mine Road, and I think there's a port attached to that as well. But at the heart of it, the deposit that's underpinning that infrastructure is so ridiculously large that this was just a way for them to help to obtain their social license with the locals, get an asset off their balance sheet that didn't really have any value to them except through use. And it was an easy thing for them to pay for over time because their life of the mine is like, I think they're talking like 40, 50 years. So
wow.
It's a long horizon. We haven't had the benefit of that. We had a shot at it when I first started taking over this job. Newmont Mining owned the Hope Bay Gold Belt, and we're hot to trot to turn it into the next Sudbury of the North. And they couldn't make the deposit work for them because it was a little bit more fractured, a little different than what they had thought. And so they vacated. But that would have been a tremendous opportunity if they'd been able to stick around and push forward with their vision.
Oh, so it all really kind of comes down to how many years worth of value you can get out of these mines, I guess.
Yeah, that's at the heart of it. And so, you know, I will also say this, when you look at other examples, you know, I mentioned the term the Slave Geological Province. That's an unbelievably large mineral-rich region that straddles the Nunavut Northwest Territories border. All the gold mines are in the all the diamond mines are in the Slave Geological Province. A couple of gold mines have gone into production and come out of production. And the known geology and deposits and reserves that are there are massive. And the view is it's very similar to what's called the Abitibi Geological Province.
Okay.
Which straddles Ontario-Quebec border and has enjoyed over 100 mines going into operation over its 100 years since its discovery. And it was discovered because the Temiskaming Northern Railway went north, pushed north into the Temiskaming region, providing simple access to a geologically unknown but seemingly rich area. And people started to take a shot at seeing what was there, and they, lo and behold, they discovered a lot of gold.
Oh, lucky them.
Yes. Yes. In our region, you know, we're in a different era. I think the view is not to look for 100 mines to go in production unless it's environmentally properly managed and Inuit are on side with it. But at the same time, to have all this metal in the ground and for Inuit not to be able to extract wealth out of the assets that they negotiated for just seems a bit daft. So,
Sure. To bring it to, you know, this current era right now with COVID-19, what kind of impact has this had on all of your projects, on infrastructure projects in general and Grays Bay specifically?
Well, it's slowed the process down. I think, you know, projects that are in construction haven't been impacted at all. I think projects that are in the planning stage, it's been difficult get the resources necessary to go out into the remote areas, because generally when you're talking remote regions, it's Indigenous, and the Indigenous communities are, as we mentioned earlier, very, very sensitive to you know, having that virus get into their communities, because it'll be a disaster. So in our specific case, we had to cancel all of our field work. We're hoping to do some work on our, we want to do a geotech drilling program at some point to confirm some of the geology at our bridge pier sites and port site and some places along the road. And we want to tuck in on some of the environmental assessment data that MMG had that needs to be updated or at least initiated. So and that was canceled. And so, you know, there hasn't been much for us to do in the absence of those activities not moving forward. So our process is pretty much ground to a halt since COVID kicked in.
Have you had trouble, continuing to convince, like, investors that this is a worthwhile project, that the Canadian North is a worthwhile part, maybe, of Canada's recovery efforts?
Well, I think there's no way we can fund the entire construction cost with third-party capital. We know that. I think everybody knows that. But when you talk about nation-building projects, there are very few in the history of Canada that you would point to as being examples of nation-building projects that were funded solely by third-party capital. Now, they're usually funded 100% by governments, whether it's provincial or provincial, territorial, or national. In our case, we've identified a bunch of different user groups. They include mineral exploration companies, companies that support mineral exploration activities, companies that support logistics and community resupply, and ideally defense and Coast Guard. To the extent that the revenues we think we can generate from those sources of use, we think can fund about $130 million worth of third-party project bonds or debt. Mm-hmm. And so I think in the context of nation-building projects normally being funded 100% by the federal government or other governments, the fact that we can fund 25 to 30% of it, I think, is should be viewed as being a huge win. And so we'll just have to wait, see whether we can, as we get closer to shovel ready and begin the construction process, whether other people will emerge out of the weeds to suddenly say, we'd be interested in using your infrastructure and happy to pay for it too. But one user group that I hadn't thought of, and it was pointed out by the diamond mines, is the diamond mines in the NWT would love to be able to cart their stuff down from Tidewater on the Arctic Ocean. They think it'd be way cheaper for them, mm-hmm. specifically fuel. And we had that confirmed by our construction contractor, who, when he said, the big cost for us is fuel, and fuel delivered from the south over the winter road is about $1.30 a liter, and fuel delivered from the north over your road or from a barge site at the Arctic on the Arctic Ocean would be about $1.10 a liter. So 20 cents a liter difference for the diamond mines, and they use something like 100 million liters a year. So it's just a whopping number, which would really help them to sustain their operation. So as I said, with those user groups, I think we can fund about 25 to 30% of the cost with third-party capital, and I think that's pretty good.
Yeah. So you see this as definitely like a nation-building exercise then?
Oh, totally. I mean, if we could somehow prove that three mines will go into production, we don't need federal government money. But the state of exploration is such that there's not enough data anywhere to suggest there are economically feasible reserves out there. We know there's one reserve at a place called Ulu that's got some relatively preliminary infrastructure at it, and it's all been fly-in stuff, but it's got almost I think it's over 500,000 ounces, but it hasn't been drilled properly, and that's really what the next step is, for someone to go in and drill the heck out of it, and it's right on our road. So
right. So I guess I'll just ask you one last question then. Where do you see this project going? When do you hope to have everything, shovel ready by?
Well, that's a very good question. We had everything very, very tightly put together related to a budget, contracts from the people who are going to be part of the development team. And a timetable, and everyone was ready to go. By not being able to move forward, clearly the cost of what we were going to be doing is going to go up. which is going to naturally make our budget unsustainable. And so I think there's going to have to be a whole bunch of discussions need to be had between, you know, with the, between KIA and the federal government to identify different sources of funds to be able to cover the increased budget and the revised timetable. So I'm optimistic that that'll happen. I think KIA's had its own set of issues during this crisis. They've been managing the distribution of monies to Inuit beneficiaries just really to keep them alive because there's been no other source of money for people to earn up there. And so this is a way for people to have money to be able to go buy food and groceries and pay their bills.
Right.
And so they've been very focused on that. They also are very focused on the fact that the one operating mine in their region has been for sale, and they have a conditional sale agreement has been put in place with a Chinese-owned entity. And you can imagine what kind of a hoo-ha that's causing right now. So they've had to manage that side of things too. So from the KIA's perspective, this project has kind of gone on the back burner. And I think the hope is in July there'll be a renewed commitment to the renewed commitment and renewed focus to try to move forward, get this thing to move forward and get it back on track.
Is there any sense that Nunavut is going to ease some of those restrictions because of COVID anytime soon, or is that already happening?
It isn't. We had one of my colleagues, the executive director of the KIA, had to accompany his wife to Edmonton for a medical procedure. Again, that's part of the challenge up there is no hospital, so they have to fly out. And the first stop is Yellowknife, and if they have a capability, they'll deal with it. Otherwise, they fly on to Edmonton. So he's now in Edmonton in the first week of his 14 days of self-quarantining to get into Nunavut. And when he gets into Nunavut after his 14 days of self-quarantining, he's got to self-quarantine again for another 14 days. So
wow.
So he'll be ready to talk when he comes out, that's for sure.
Yeah, he'll have some stories of the COVID era.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, so no. Short answer is no. There's no restrict. I think there are a lot of people in the mining industry really hoping that they'll be able to do some kind of an exploration or field program this summer, and I'm not convinced that's the case at this stage.
Yeah. Summer is going quicker than I expected it to, considering I'm pretty sure yesterday it was March.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
All of a sudden, I'm expected to wear shorts. I don't know what that's about.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, Scott, thank you so much for talking to me today.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Erica. Appreciate it.
That's it for today on COVID-19 in Grays Bay. Big thanks to Scott Northey for sitting down with us. Stay tuned for next week. See you then.